Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
You know, he's made a career as like a provocative comedian.
So, as the guy who made Trollhunter, he made any other movie?
I think so. Let me just double check, because I get my Norwegian directors mixed up.
What coaster do you want?
André Øverdahl. Yeah, of course.
What coaster do you want, Andy?
Could I have a look?
Yeah, they're right in front of you.
Diego.
Diego. There you go, sticking a nut on there.
Thanks very much.
You can put a filet, you put in the elbow on Zabaleta.
Yeah.
Joey Barton sticking one on Sergio Aguero or Sergio Ramos.
I'd like some filet. I'd like some hot, steamy filet action.
I'll take Sergio Ramos.
Quique Setién is the new manager of Barcelona, replacing Ernesto Valverde. There's been plenty of chat of Setién being fourth choice. The recruitment process has received a huge amount of criticism, with one Spanish football journalist calling it a Keystone Cops affair from start to finish. And already the talk is that it will only be a placeholder ahead of Xavi taking the job next year. Chaps, what do you make of the appointment, and would you endorse the criticism that this appointment has attracted?
Well, I think in some ways it makes a kind of perfect sense, even though they've not arrived at the decision in necessarily the most linear way. But this is a guy who adores Cruyff and Cruyff's legacy more than any of the other candidates in the frame.
And that's all you need for the job.
Well, it's a start, isn't it?
Can I see your bedroom wall? Yes, there are enough Johan Cruyff posters on there. Please start on Monday.
If you're a middle-aged man with posters on your wall, you've got questions to ask yourself.
I bet Bielsa has.
Yeah, I bet, yes. But I think you've got to bear in mind, the only La Liga game that Ernesto Valverde lost at home was to Quique Setién's Betis as well, which I think is quite interesting.
Why don't we start with the Valverde legacy?
I think what happens at the Camp Nou is very important for the Valverde legacy, and it's very important for the way that Valverde was perceived and the way that things have turned, certainly to the discomfort of the club only relatively recently. I think what you've got to bear in mind when you look at how things are at Barcelona and how the mood is at Barcelona. We always look at it, because they're a global mega club now, a lot through the prism of angry fans on Twitter and the "this can't go on" after they lost at Roma in the Romontada, and after they lost at Liverpool, this absolutely has to be the end. But things are perceived slightly differently back home, and I think if you look at the pressure in the stadium, this is not a stadium, a Camp Nou, in which the players get whistled like they are at the Bernabeu. You rarely have a situation with Cristiano Ronaldo or Gareth Bale or anyone who's anyone has been whistled at Real Madrid, haven't they?
Yeah.
And that doesn't really happen at Camp Nou. If a player is getting whistled, it's serious, because it's not something that happens to all players, and it certainly doesn't happen to blokes who score more than the goal a game for 9 years, although he's over it now, you understand.
Yeah.
The fact that things had started to turn, I think you have to look at El Clásico as a turning point, and El Clásico is almost always a turning point for either club. You know, you think of that long, unbeaten run that Manuel Pellegrini went on, and he lost the Clásico, and all of a sudden it was worth nothing at Real Madrid. And the way they played in El Clásico, and what's kept trouble at arm's length for Valverde for a lot of the time, is that a lot of fans don't go away, and a lot of the fans in the stadium really enjoyed the performances. You know, they've been pretty, they've had their challenges on the road, there's no doubt about that, especially this season. And that sort of follows on from what happened in Rome and what happened in Liverpool. But at home, they have looked like old Barcelona for a lot of the time. But El Clásico was different, because you had a Real Madrid side who were supposedly there for the taking, who come along, not only escape with a 0-0 draw, but are the better team. And as Real Madrid would argue, with a better application of VAR, might have actually won the game as well. And that is a point at which people who start to come every week start putting the pressure on and start thinking, this isn't good enough. So that is where you go from people not being over the moon with Valverde and him not having 100% approval rating to people thinking, okay, maybe it's time for a change. I think you have to look overall, and with time, people will look at Valverde's spell in charge and say, okay, he wasn't the greatest Barcelona coach either, but neither was he Tata Martino or, you know, second coming of Louis van Gaal. Because as we've made this point several times on this show, but I'm going to have to make it again, because as he's gone, we're never going to make it again. if you go back to the beginning, when he took over, Barcelona were not only not favourites for La Liga, they were not second favourites for La Liga. Neymar had left. They had all this stuff going on in the city with the call for the Catalan independence referendum. Remember, they played that game behind closed doors against them. Was it Las Palmas? Mm. Anyway, the fact is that Valverde got on with them and made them efficient. And in terms of up until this season, season one and season two in La Liga were absolutely peerless. And this is something that is still worth winning. People think of everything in Champions League terms. But to win La Liga is not easy. It's not a given in this day and age. You know, in an age when Paris Saint-Germain win it every season, Juventus win it every season, Barcelona have won it almost every season. And they've come back to that point under Valverde. But it's not been easy because they've had to cope with Real Madrid. It's not even a two-team league. You've got Atletico who have been serious for the last 5, 6, 7 years. So what he's been able to do domestically with them is very impressive. Was he quite brave enough to get it done in the Champions League, I suppose, is the biggest question.
Mm. It's useful to go back to the summer of 2017 when he took over, when the club had been completely wrong-footed by Neymar leaving. That's not something they saw in the pipeline at all. He was sort of set up to be Messi's long-term heir and all of this. And suddenly Neymar leaves. The board kind of freaks out and panics and pays way too much money for Ousmane Dembele. Later on in January, they proceed to pay probably way too much money for Coutinho as well, without a clear plan of how to use him. And Valverde is kind of left having to manage this situation. And he does these things like bring in Paulinho, or whether that was him or not, and I don't know, but Paulinho was brought in and he plays 4-4-2 a lot. Like, he completely goes against the traditions of Barcelona, but the end result is that they win the league by 14 points. So he deserves credit for that. And I think going forward, I think he will be remembered as someone who managed a difficult situation really quite well, even if the social media fans and the international fans, as we've called them, are quite furious about the way things unraveled. But I think maybe the most sort of instructive thing you can look at in terms of what went wrong for Valverde, why he's being replaced, why they've sacked a guy who's top of the league, is by looking at the people they've spoken to be his replacements. There was an interest in Ronald Koeman. There was a very well publicized interest in Xavi, and there's even been suggested they spoke to Thierry Henry a while back as well. And you've ended up with Quique Setién.
Yeah,
and you've ended up with Quique Setién. And what that tells you, what that screams at you, is that they really are freaking out about losing their identity, right? And that they want to go back to someone who's perceived as having the Barcelona DNA in them and knowing the club. That's that lovely phrase, knowing the club. And ironically, I think you get that much more with Setién than you would have with Koeman, for instance, than you would have certainly sure. than one you would have from Thierry Henry, and possibly with Xavi, we don't know. But you can ask Everton fans, you know, how much Barcelona DNA did he manage to spray onto the club? Not that much. So with Setién, you get someone who really just not just idolizes that way of doing it, but has actually tried to implement that sort of passing possession game, playing out from the back, creating passing triangles, creating numerical overloads in certain areas of the pitch, all this sort of Barcelona stuff he's implemented at other much smaller clubs with much fewer resources.
That's the thing. Sorry, Luke. I was going to say, is a point. I was at a La Liga TV launch yesterday, and the point that Gustavo Poyet made is, before what Setien's done, he's never had players like this. So, you know, he's going to get the chance to put his, and the best of Setién, the football is beautiful. And it really was with Las Palmas.
Betis were a team to watch. We talked about them a lot.
Yeah. When it fell apart at both clubs, it really fell apart. So there's questions over the interpersonal dynamic of him and players. And I think especially big players, that's something we have to look out for. But yeah, Poyet did make this point. He's not had this chance with players of anywhere near this standard before, so it could be something for him.
Andy mentioned the game where he took Betis to the Camp Nou and they won, and I think it was that they won, of course, and 4-3, wasn't it? It wasn't that they won playing the kind of football the Barcelona crowd kind of wants their own team to play and haven't really seen in the last couple of years. I think that's what made such a big impression. And I mean, I don't think he gets that job now if that game doesn't happen and doesn't play out the way it did, honestly, because I think that's kind of the way football can be sometimes.
You mentioned the La Liga launch. That I noticed that Mauricio Pochettino was there as well. And as we referenced the appointment of Setién at Barcelona, I don't know if it's to be believed, but it was reported that Pochettino himself was actually approached. And he responded by saying that he'd rather go back to manage a farm in Argentina than manage Barcelona.
He didn't say that last night.
Did he not? What did he say last night? Well, tell us what he said last night.
Well, he ducked it with about as much elegance as old Ian Ormondroyd used to hit the ball at the back post for Aston Villa.
That's a sad matter-faced tortured metaphor.
Unexpected.
So do you think it's right that do you think the criticism of the process to appoint him is fair, or do you think
it's a mess? It's a mess.
Okay,
it's a mess. And I think that's the interesting thing that's easy to overlook about Valverde. The fact that there was no plan at all when they got rid of him. But if you go back to the beginning, when he took over, and in La Liga terms, he's very reliable, very solid, not just with the body of work that he's shown at Barcelona, but you look at the lighthouse that he was at Athletic before that. Also, he managed to provide Batfink style wings of steel.
Batfink? I mean, what are these references?
What is happening today?
I'm having an 80s morning.
I'm going to have to do so much explanation in this synopsis if you carry on like this. Ian Ormond-Jordan, Batfink.
I know, in the space of 2 minutes, isn't it?
My wings are like a shield of steel, right?
Exactly. Weird. But he kind of shielded the board from people saying, you let Neymar go. You're incompetent. You can't run everything. And people stopped talking about that because he got the team eventually.
Because of the Ramontada.
Because he got the team winning week after week.
Never mind off the pitch. Look at what happens on the pitch.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but domestically, you're right. He did a very strong job.
Yeah, he did. And what he got out of Messi. I mean, it's always about getting a tune out of your star players. How good has Messi been under Valverde? I'm not saying that's all down to Valverde, but with the 4-4-2. Gave him the conditions to succeed, and giving him the conditions to succeed post Neymar is no small thing.
Og så er han konsekvent i sin indgriben. Han har stået en stor kamp, synes jeg, Mogens Krogh. Ole Bjørn, selvfølgelig. Og igen usikkerhed viser David James.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Let's turn our attention to France then, because... Thank you. It's a very basic we. Do you want to get that again? Yeah, we go. Because Robert Moreno took charge. Careful. We've told you before, your swearing is acceptable as long as it's in Norwegian.
No one
can understand you. Robert Moreno took charge of Monaco for the first time. He took his side to Paris for the first of two games in Ligue 1 against PSG. And to be fair, I'd say they passed that first examination, didn't they? The game finished 3-3 and they were able to drag themselves back into it after being 3-2 down. But they also played again last night, this time... in Paris or in Monaco?
In Monaco. Because they were the two league games.
That's right.
Because of rearrangement, played twice in 4 days.
I mean, and the game finished, I just finished by saying, the game finished 4-1 to PSG. Yeah. Baptism of fire, to say the least. Lots been made of this PSG. What are they being called? The Fantastic Four. What do you make of that? And what do you also make of Moreno's start at the Red and Whites?
Well, Moreno's start, his first league game in Paris, as you say, the 3-3 draw, was, I watched it with Lars, and it was is such a brave performance, and it worked.
No invite for me, guys. It worked. Thank you very much. Was it Sunday night? Were you doing it before Trans Europe?
Yeah, that's yeah.
Before and during. Right.
Nice. Oh, were you? Okay.
And we're multitask. We're very good at these things.
Yeah, we are. Good on us.
I saw Extended Heights this game, and I was impressed by Monaco's kind of the way they stuck at the task. It really smacked to me of a team with a new manager. Well,
they went a goal down after 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You can overlook that to Neymar. True. And then you think,
oh, God, it's going to be seven. Yeah. Exactly. It's going to be seven.
Flashback to Thierry Henry.
Exactly. But the bravery with which they played was fantastic. Wissam Ben Yedder, I think, underlined again what an incredible player he is. But also, you look at other players in the team, like Golovin was fantastic. And he is a player who came in for Monaco a very, very difficult time. And again, if he can be given the platform to flourish by Moreno, who's like left his print on the team already, I think, which is quite notable.
In what way?
Then that would be well, because they've been braver, they've been more expressive, and you go back to the first game they played in the Coupe de France against Reims. Not an easy game to win by any stretch of the imagination. Reims are pretty tough to break down. They stuck at it and they won the game right at the end. I think in a way, it kind of goes back to the early days of Leonardo Jardim, his first spell, because the players enjoyed Jardim so much because they did so much with the ball.
Mm.
And, you know, players don't always get the opportunity to do that, do they? Especially under a new coach who's trying to instill discipline and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, he's brought some freshness to the place. He's stimulated minds. And they've played in a more loose sort of 4-4-2 that's given those players the ability to express themselves a little bit, which I think has been helpful as well. But as anyone who's taken a partner away to Paris for the weekend knows, coming back home afterwards and retaining the magic is very, very difficult indeed. And it certainly was, because I think there are two reasons for this. Firstly, Paris clearly got a large bollocking for the openness with which they played in that game against Monaco at the Parc des Princes.
Hmm.
Secondly, who'd want to play PSG twice in 4 days in the league? I mean, that's just inhuman. And I think the players were a little bit tired from that, Monaco's players as well. And this time, it was more Paris pressed better. And so Monaco's openness played against them. A lot of the time, Timore Bakayoko looked a bit on his own in the middle with Golovin not willing to protect him and Fabregas not really able to.
Mm.
So that left them a little bit outnumbered. And a lot of attention has been drawn among the Fantastic Four to not just Kylian Mbappe scoring those two goals in the second game, but also Angel Di Maria. Because, I mean, there was an article in The Keep this morning saying he can either make or break the Fantastic Four. Because, of course, there's a huge question. Can they use these four in a big Champions League game?
Mm.
That has got to be a question, because it does leave them a little bit open. But Di Maria worked himself so hard. He made a lot of challenges. He won the ball a lot. He also gave the ball away a lot, which I think has implications in transition, especially when you look at them playing Dortmund in the Champions
and
League.
And Andy, one thing I find really interesting about that is my first instinct when you look at this Fantastic Four, particularly in this game where they won 4-1, the game last night, and you mentioned there, and I completely agree, it puts a lot of pressure on the team because it leaves them open. I was surprised to see, I didn't actually see this game, so you can fill in the blanks for me.
Yes.
I was surprised to see, they played Idrissa Gueye in holding midfield, but they played him alongside a 17-year-old holding midfield player.
Yeah, Tanguy Kouassi, who found it hard.
Right, but they still won the game fairly easily. Presumably they just outgunned Monaco then.
Yeah, they did. And like I said, Di Maria put in such a shift as well.
But it puts a lot of pressure on Verratti and Gueye, right?
Oh yeah, there's absolutely no doubt about that. It's tough. And, Verratti, he does save some of his best games for the Champions League, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. No, but I was just saying what happened in the first game on Sunday was I thought Monaco were very, very good at exploiting the flanks. And I think this is going to be a big problem for PSG if they are going to try to use the Fantastic Four.
It makes them narrow.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it does inevitably, because they line up in something very similar to the sort of Manuel Pellegrini magic box or magic rectangle thing that he deployed both at Real Madrid and at Man City with sort of Mbappe and Icardi up front and Neymar and Di Maria sort of in kind of drifty wide roles coming inside a lot. that leaves an awful lot for your fullbacks to do if the opponents overload the flanks, which Monaco did a lot in Paris. They did that very successfully. It's kind of funny, actually. You can check this out yourself. If you look at the heat map, I'm the only person in the world who starts a sentence with "it's kind of funny" and goes straight to heat maps.
Yeah.
If you look at the Monaco heat map from the game in Paris, there's like nothing in the middle. Like they did, they just gave up. We're not going to attack through the middle. We're going to overload the flanks constantly. Yeah. And that's what caused a lot of problem for Paris. I too missed the game last night, and it doesn't look like they did the same, Andy.
No, and they simply weren't able to, I think, because PSG hemmed them in. You know, there was a lot more work on Monaco, and I think a part of that is them feeling like we should have done better in the first game, and Tuchel telling them they should have done better in the first game. But also, Monaco tend to be a little bit more timid at home, and that's going to be a big challenge for Moreno going forward. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Another interesting thing I thought, apart from, because of course with Paris, we expect them to win Ligue 1 at Canter. So we are looking forward to the Dortmund tie in the Champions League.
That'll be a fascinating encounter.
It will. Now, the thing that, again, people have drawn attention to is not just can they play this way in the Champions League. And bear in mind that Di Maria played this kind of shuttler role, almost making a third person in midfield when they won the Champions League final in 2014. I mean, he was the man of the match in that. He was outstanding. He was the one who saw them past Atletico when Atletico really flagging in the final stages of it and in extra time. A lot of people have drawn attention to Keylor Navas. I think L'Équipe said this morning that he's one of the best. Keylor Navas is one of the best five goalkeepers in the world on his line. But on his line, you look at the goal that Bakayoko ends up scoring, which is just a consolation.
Yeah.
It comes out not really anywhere near a free kick, and Bakayoko just bundles it in at the back post. And he made a couple of great saves in that early on, actually. And we do have to say Monaco had a few good chances early on. Gelson Martins, who was fantastic in that first game, wasn't he?
He was.
And
he scored the equaliser in the first one, yeah.
Yeah. And the question of that is an issue with Dortmund because, of course, straight away you think Dortmund, you know, Hummels, Akanji, Haaland now as well. there are lots of targets to get in Navas's face. And, you know, it's funny, when you project forward to that game, you wouldn't immediately think, all right, Dortmund are going to undo them from set pieces, but maybe they could.
Well, what I think, looking ahead of that game at potential matchups, if Tuchel is going to play all four of them, which he'll probably be under some pressure to do, actually.
Are Dortmund the worst team to do that against?
Because,
well, they go out of the stage every year anyway.
But I look just, at, just but I
look, might as well have fun doing it.
But I look at the, I look at the left side of the pitch in particular for PSG. It is notionally Neymar who plays wide left in midfield there, but of course he's going to A, not defend much, and B, sort of drift in a lot. And then it's Juan Bernat on the left back, who's not an amazing defensive left back. They're coming up against, they'll be coming up against that fearsome right side with Jadon Sancho and Hakimi and this sort of thing. I mean,
who's not an amazing defensive left back? It's like having a more polite version of Uli Hoeneß here.
A lot of people call me that, Andy. Imagine, like, you've got Hakimi and Sancho overloading against Juan Bernat all night. I mean, that's a really bad day at the office.
There will be plenty of time for us to preview the Champions League games, so we'll do that in due course. But just very quickly before we move on, because there's a fantastic story with Christophe Galtier that I want to get to in a minute, I'd like to know if you guys can give us any insight into the type of coach you think Robert Moreno is going to be, because he's been very itinerant. He's worked a lot as an assistant under Luis Enrique. He's managed at a lower level. He had, what, 9 games in charge of Spain?
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it. So he's in this position where he's at a big club in a big league going up against, you know, one of the world's best teams. What have we learned from these two games that can tell us the type of coach he's going to be?
Well, I think we've found out with Arsenal and Mikel Arteta that so much of being a head coach is about projection and about the way you present yourself, certainly in the early stages. And that's where he's made a really strong impression. People know he's a guy who likes to quote philosophers and stuff in his press conferences, and he's got a really strong idea of how the game should be played. I think that's very, very important for Monaco early on. I think this is very different to, like, people have compared it to, say, Thierry Henry taking charge at Monaco. I think it couldn't be more different.
Right.
That's not to say that Moreno is a guaranteed success. Of course, no coach is a guaranteed success. But This is someone with a very strong courage of his convictions, who is experienced. As you say, he was involved at Roma, Celta, Barcelona, Spain. He was a big part of Luis Enrique's successes. And I think that's an interesting thing to watch going on. How will Luis Enrique go on with a new team without someone who was his most trusted lieutenant next to him? I think that could potentially make a difference. But for Moreno, it's a chance that he's been preparing himself for a very long time. You know, he's been singing into a microphone in his bedroom for a very long time, and now he's actually out there on stage.
What's he been singing?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably some sort of like Serge Gainsbourg or something like that, because he is quite a philosophical guy.
Yeah.
So that's probably why he'll fit in Ligue 1.
I think he's doing the Macarena over and over.
Well, listen, like Luis Enrique, we wish him all the best. Lille coach Christophe Galtier has given probably one of the more embarrassing post-match team talks of his career. Lille lost 1-0 to Dijon on Sunday afternoon, leaving them in fifth position. Of course, they finished second last year, didn't they?
Yes.
And Galtier admonished his side for losing to a team, and this is a quote, of painters and maintenance men, depending on which translation you read. The kicker being that it was overheard by a whole lot of journalists.
Well, the thing we have to say is about the Stade Gaston-Gérard. Basically, the press room is
Right next to
the away dressing room, and Galtier was really shouting at them. And they heard all of it, and he could just tell from the looks on their faces when he came into the press conference. Yeah.
He did an amazing thing when he came out. He said, I know you heard me, it was just anger. And then apologised for calling Dijon the team that he called them.
I didn't get to through the news. I saw this on our WhatsApp group first.
Yeah.
And you said that Galtier had given his team talk to the journalist. I thought he'd just gone to the wrong room and just sort of read the riot act.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, yeah, journalists famously can get a bit sort of defensive and aggressive. So I think Galtier would maybe get what he wants from players from them.
Well, I think it's something interesting because Galtier is someone who his manner in the press conference was really fun because he's not normally that sort of circumspect. That is his personality. He's a real front foot sort of guy. I think he's been holding a lot of pent up anger since Jose Mourinho pinched his two assistants, to be honest.
I bet.
Because he's pretty furious about that, and he couldn't hide that in front of the media. So I think this could be the sort of bloodletting that he needed after that.
But is it too early to say or suggest that perhaps the wheels are starting to come off for him? Because I mean, the last game, but they obviously lost to Dijon away, who were an average team. The last, I know there was a couple of cup games in between that, which they did okay against teams you'd perhaps expect them to beat. Before that, they were beaten quite heavily by Monaco, and a 10-man Monaco as well. Monaco played the last 20, 25 minutes with 10 men, and they still lost 5-1, Lille. So is it too early for us to be saying, what's going on here?
There have to be some questions, definitely. But I think globally, you take the season as a whole, they lost a lot of players. They lost some big players, and they're always in this vulnerable financial position.
But a team of that profile will always have that situation if they do well.
Well, I think of their financial position. That's what they're sort of coming back against. And, you know, I think if you look at them medium term, the fact that they've been able to get that entirely unexpected Champions League money, that they've been able to get that amount of money for Nicolas Pepe, and I'm sure Arsenal fans are still raising their eyebrows. Bear in mind, the year before, Lille wanted to sell him to Lyon for 30 million euros. He refused to go, stayed, had the season of his life, got them in the Champions League, and they sold him for nearly treble the price the next summer. I mean, they owe a lot to Nicolas Pepe. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But yeah, there has been a bit of disquiet
as opposed
recently
to Arsenal, who owe a lot for Nicolas Pepe.
Yeah. And I think when you look back at that, the Monaco defeat is quite an interesting one because they've earlier in that week, they beat Monaco in the Coupe de la Ligue.
That's right.
Which was about 4 days before. And they beat them 3-0. Mm. It could have been 10. Like with no exaggeration, Monaco were awful, and it was too easy for Lille. Really, I don't know if that got them like believing their own publicity a little bit. There's maybe that sense with the way they went about it and lost the game at the weekend afterwards. And there has been the sense that Galtier has held this frustration with his team as well as with the situation. Now he's dropped Jose Font as well, which is a big deal. the last couple of games. So he's clearly trying to send a message to his team. And now that message really is out there, albeit a little inadvertently.
His message is out there because he gave it direct to the journalist.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, when we're talking about coaches getting their message out there, of course he didn't do it in quite the same aggressive way, is André Villas-Boas this week, because Marseille in a great position in the league. They won your game of the week last week.
Narrowly, 1-0.
At Rennes. Yeah. Mm. Kevin Strootman goal. Is that why you picked it as game of the week?
You could see
a Kevin Strootman.
To be honest, from what I saw, it was a poor game. And Strootman scored late on where he followed up a free kick. It was a nice free kick, hit the post, came out, and he put it into the top corner.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as I can...
Well, 400 grand a month of anyone.
Yeah, I know, but as far as I can tell, that was really the only thing that happened in the game. Was there a goal that was disallowed? I can't remember, but anyway.
Yeah, it wasn't an exciting game.
It wasn't a great game, though.
No, it wasn't, but, you know, they won it against their...
It's a big win for them.
Their closest rivals.
Absolutely, yeah.
For second place, so that was big. But it was interesting because this week it came out that... Marseille have employed a guy called Paul Aldridge, who's worked for a number of clubs in England, including West Ham.
Sounds made up.
Bolton.
West Ham?
Sounds like I'm making it up.
Yeah.
It's like a West random name generator.
He played
random transfer advisor name generator.
He played for Tranmere and Macclesfield Town, apparently.
Also made up.
Yeah. I didn't mean the clubs, I meant the man's name. But yeah, so he's there to try and help sell French players to Premier League, basically.
Yeah, that's right. And Villas-Boas came out and said, well, look, if you want to sell players to the Premier League, the best way to do it is to carry on playing well. But it's interesting because Villas-Boas has been there before. And with coaches, like with Rafa Benitez, with anyone else, we do look
for... Sorry, that's my chair, by the way. Apologies.
We do look for recurrent patterns of behaviour, don't we? And with Villas-Boas...
Leaving is one of them.
Yeah, I mean, he said before, you know, for me, it's not about... He said in this press conference, it's not about money. He said, I walked out on 12 million net in China to go and do the Paris-Dakar rally. And of course he...
Because he got paid off about 50 million from Chelsea as well.
Yeah. And of course he walked out of Zenit as well because he was frustrated by the foreign player rules that existed there at the time in the Russian Premier League.
At Russians in general.
So I think everyone's on their guard already a little bit because what Villas-Boas doesn't want to do is go into a squad with this, go into the Champions League next season if they should make it, and they do look in a good position to make it, with either a squad as strong as it is at the moment or less strong than it is at the moment. He wants strengthening. Now, he knew what he was getting when he got into this job at Marseille. He knew that, you know, they didn't have money. They were trying to sell the big earners, Strootman, Dimitri Payet. But the reality of that, I think... It must have been a part of him that thought, well, if I do manage to get us in the Champions League, and especially because the season's gone far better than expected, I expect a little bit more going into next season. But because they're in a certain financial position, like Lille before, the Champions League money is going to be significant, obviously, but it's not going to completely turn around the way they are. They still need to be careful. And I wonder if the reality of dealing with that is something that he's ready to accept. Mm.
Inter drew against Atalanta.
They did.
In Nicky Bandini's game of the week to hand the initiative in Serie A to Juve, who of course won at Roma. Cristiano Ronaldo has now scored 10 in his last 8 for Juve. Lars, you've noticed a pattern here with Inter that you literally insisted we had to talk about today. So please take it away. The floor is yours.
It tied into another couple of things you wanted to talk about. It's this thing with Inter is that... I know you're going to object, but let me say, if only first halves counted, they'd be top of the league. Now, given how close they are to the top of the league, you might say that that's not a big whoop. But if only first halves counted, they'd actually be a full 12 points ahead of Juventus.
12?
Yes.
Wow.
For the first half, they've been in the lead going into halftime in 13 out of 19 games.
But Juventus do finish strongly as well,
exactly,
don't they?
Exactly. But the point is, under Conte, what we're seeing time and time and again with Inter is that they come out strong, they run at you, They run around, they do all the things, and then they run out of steam a little bit in the second half of games. And in this case, it was very clear that Atalanta just really took over and just battered them at times.
They're a nightmare to play against Atalanta.
And Atalanta are
absolutely relentless.
So in isolation, dropping a point against Atalanta is kind of fine. But going into this game, Atalanta had scored 10 goals in their last two games, admittedly against Milan and Parma. But, you know, so it's not a bad point as such. But you're seeing that they are running out of steam a little bit in these games. And with Juventus not being completely amazing this season, there is a real opportunity for them to win the Scudetto and end the Juve dominance. Conte famously does well in his first seasons. And I think Conte, it's easy to make fun of him for always wanting more players and always, oh, I'm down to the bare bones, and I need all these dudes. But they have a chance there now, and it does seem they've had some injuries that have affected his options. And they do actually, they could really do with an extra couple of bodies in the window.
Well, they've, and your point about them running out of steam in the second half of that, I mean, they would have lost that game if it wasn't from the Handanovic penalty save from Luis Muriel. And of course, a calendar year has only really started after Sami Handanovic saves a penalty, in my opinion. But they are looking to be active in this transfer window. I mean, they've already got rid of Politano in that swap with Spinazzola, and that they clearly wanted a bit of cover at left back or left wing back.
Spinazzola looking excited about being at Inter. They did this thing with the journalist.
Apparently, he'd just come off a flight.
The journalist was at the airport.
Like 8 hours,
filming him.
Is it?
He looks terrified. He looks upset.
He looks like me when the alarm goes and it's like 6 a.m. or something. It's like, oh God, this again. But that just might be a natural reaction to realizing he's about to play wing back for Antonio Conte. I mean, it's not. I could go somewhere and take a nap.
Isn't it key though as well that not only that? I mean, we know about. I mean, at time of recording, it's not happened. We expect Olivier Giroud to go there as well. But isn't it also important for them to keep hold of some players as well?
The swap of Politano is quite an interesting one, because Politano is quite a useful utility player for them. Obviously, Roma wanted him in to replace Nicolò Saniolo, who got that cruciate ligament injury against Juventus last weekend, which quite affect them going forward. So Politano gets to go back to Roma and try and fulfil his prophecy and all that sort of stuff. The interesting thing about Giroud, Lars, is that he's not going to be any further.
No, he keeps doing this.
He's not going to be any further up the pecking order, because he's done it to preserve his place in the France 2020 squad.
Yeah.
He won't be any further up the pecking order, but he will play more minutes, won't he?
He probably will, but it's so funny that he's like, oh, I've got to leave Arsenal, I'm not playing enough. So he goes to Chelsea under Conte and he never plays. And now he's going to Inter under Conte and he's not going to be first choice either.
I think last...
can you just go and play football somewhere, Oliver?
People who listen to Football Ramble Day regularly will may I sound like a broken record, but I think he has been so criminally underused in the last few seasons. It's unreal.
But if he makes this decision now, and maybe he doesn't have a lot of options, but he, you know, Romelu Lukaku has been brilliant for Inter, and he's not a guy who gets hurt very often, and you go into that thinking, oh, this will be fine. Like, you can't be surprised when he finds himself on the bench a lot.
I'm not saying that Inter will or should use him. I'm sure they probably won't, but for a guy of his age and a guy of his ability, I think he needs to have made some better decisions.
Yeah, I like him.
You know what, I'm sure there are people, while we're on the subject of Milanese football, Lars, like looking at their device at the moment and saying, how many minutes in are we? And he's not even talked about Zlatan's first goal back.
You know, I'm keeping the dry.
Goal as well. He put the ball to his feet. He'll smash it in the corner, no problem.
Yeah, well, we've said this. I mean,
like a latter-day Kanu.
But it's not the worst comparison. No, yeah. So imagine if you had Andy Carroll, but his first touch was amazing and he could stay fit and he could execute any number of technically difficult finishes.
To be fair to Carroll, he can kind of do that. Yeah,
this is the thing. Like, I make fun of Ibra for being slow, and he still is, but I think if you can get the ball to him into the box, he can create a lot of trouble. And that was what the goal was like. Like, there was just a ball played into him in the box. No Cagliari players felt a great urge to mark him in any kind of way, and he sort of whacks it in first time, and he's going to do that if you can get the ball to him.
But Lars, we talked last week about his role as a Rafael Leao whisperer.
Yeah.
It seems to be starting quite well, doesn't it?
Yeah, Leao's scored a goal.
He's whispered Pepe Reina out of there.
Yeah, no, I do think... I think for...
He will not tolerate David Mays.
He will not tolerate someone being like a cheerleader, but not as aggressive a cheerleader as he is.
It's not the most progressive form of football, but if you're in the situation where Milan are in, where they've just been, like, just... awful. They've been so bad, Milan, and nothing's really working for them. It's not really about, like, you can't play a sort of high tempo pressing game with Ibra up there. No. But, I mean, they're not playing any kind of game so far this season, Milan. They've just been really bad. So you get a guy in who, if you can get balls to him in the box, he'll get you a couple of goals. He'll get everyone a little bit excited, and you really just change the conversation. We were talking earlier about how Valverde changed the conversation for Barcelona, away from the board being terrible and everything being awful. Like, at least people are talking about Ibra being there rather about Milan being being a mess.
Can we just spare a quick thought for Lazio as well? We appear to have gone a bit under the radar on this show, and I think probably in general. Third in Serie A, 6 points off the top with a game in hand. If they win the game in hand, they'll go 1 point behind Inter. They've won at least their last six, probably more than
10
that.
In a row.
So they've won 10 in a row. There we go. No one's got a better goal difference than them. Immobile is scoring goals for fun. Do we think they can hang around? This is a team who's only won two Scudetti in their history, the last one being in 2000. Could they hang around a bit longer?
Where's Marcus Bellet? So that was under.
That's where I can bring in my halftime table again, because second halves, the second half table is kind of misleading because teams who are ahead of after the first half will kind of ease off a bit.
Yeah.
But the Lazio's goal difference in second halves this season is extraordinary. In 18 games, they've scored 23 in the second half of the game, conceded three.
Good.
Wow. Three second half conceded goals.
So will they push that through
games
to the second half of this season?
Hey,
that's what I want to know.
I think they can. I don't think they can continue to win every single game, but I think you have to take them very seriously. And this is a team who's very well coached on the Simone Inzaghi. They haven't had a huge amount of squad turnover. This is a group of players who have been together for a long time. I guess my main concern would be, can Ciro Immobile keep scoring at the rate he is?
Well, he can if he plays David Ospina every week.
That was like, you got a feel for Napoli, and like a lot of things have gone wrong for them this season.
And Napoli played well in that game.
Yeah,
they actually played well at that.
Enter Ospina. Well, hey, but no, if you look at our old friend expected goals, Ciro Immobile has scored way too many goals and then converted commas. He's been very efficient with the chances he's had. Mm. And that could be that he's suddenly become one of the best finishers in Europe, but it could also be that he's had the luck of the bounce a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think the thing is with them, you do think with Milinkovic-Savic and Luis Alberto, he will continue to get chances. I think that is the big thing, really, for Lazio, isn't it? And they are a really good side. I know that there'll be a lot of listeners thinking they're a very dislikable club, or there's a very dislikable element of their fan base. But you can only have admiration for what they've been doing on the pitch. And they're genuine title tenders now, Luke. There's absolutely no question about that. I think like they had that on the front page of, I think it was Corriere dello Sport, Lazio for the Scudetto last week, because they are genuinely in the mix. And you're right, they have crept up by stealth. But I think it's quite interesting. If you look at the fixtures that are coming up for them, Rome Derby at the end of the month. Now that is absolutely huge. It's absolutely huge for them. And it's also absolutely huge for Roma. Now, I think if we're being realistic, if Lazio were to finish top three, that would still be a really tremendous season. Now, I know what Lars is saying about them retaining players, and that's quite right. And I think the fact that they've still got Milinkovic-Savic now. And
that went quiet for a long time. He was being talked of, a 100 million euro move to everywhere at one point.
Yeah. And
he wasn't great last season.
He wasn't. I think off the back of not getting that move, because I think Lazio overestimated the market for him when they were pricing him. You know, there wasn't the sense outside Italy that there was inside Italy of how good he was. I think that made a difference. But having him back in form is good. But you know, they haven't invested a fortune in players by any stretch of the imagination. So for them to be doing that with what they've got is very impressive. But still, I think if they finish top three, realistically, that's great. And for them, it's not just about getting closer to like challenging the top two, because I still think they'll struggle to sustain it over the last 3 or 4 months of the season. It's about creating space between them and Roma, because Roma are still in the mix for top four, obviously.
But I do think it's a slightly underrated aspect in modern football of teams who are actually able to keep a core group of players together. Like you can run into trouble down the line if people sort of and reach the end of their peak at the same time, like we've seen with Tottenham and we've seen with maybe actually to an extent with Napoli. Certainly that's a group that maybe should have been freshened up a bit earlier. But when you have a team like Lazio where Milinkovic-Savic and Lucas and Alberto in midfield have sort of been together for three seasons and know each other really well, I think that's really valuable. Lars,
in addition to that, they've got a great combination of youth and experience. You look at the players they've got, like Lucas Leiva, Amit Immobile's been around the block, Radu's what, 33 now, Acerbi's in his 30s. They've got some good experience to add with some interesting young players as well. Strakosch has been around for a long time and in goal as well.
He has. Immobile is quite an interesting one because I think now we can look at players and if we feel they've failed at a couple of big moves, we can write them off quite easily. But Immobile is a little bit like, say, I don't know, Luis Fabiano, for example, who had two unsuccessful stabs at big European clubs. I know it's a different context coming from South America.
Yeah.
But before he really took off at Sevilla, he had a miserable time at Rennes. That can happen. Went back to Brazil. But he had a second stab at Porto directly after the Mourinho years. And you were thinking then, well, you know, if it hasn't worked out at Porto, is it going to work out in Europe for him? Probably not. And you look at Immobile, and there was the Dortmund move, and obviously that was post Lewandowski. That was a very tall order. I know him and his family quite found it quite difficult to adapt to Germany on a cultural level as well. And then he went to Sevilla, and that didn't happen for him as well. So that he's been able to come back from those two moves, and you know, people still look at him as a certain type of striker who needs certain types of conditions to succeed. So the fact that he is at this point in his career, in his late 20s, just able to score such a volume of goals, I think is very, very impressive.
All right, let's round up some transfers that have come into English football this window so far then. After much fanfare and rumour, Jadson Fernandes has signed for Spurs. He's a talented attacking midfield player, but he hasn't played an awful lot this season. He looks quite skillful, can go past a player, but he also looks very strong as well.
Yeah, he's not really an attacking midfield player.
More of an ace type, isn't he?
Right, okay. Okay, well, tell us about that.
He's got a good defensive side to his game, and I think that's where he's going to benefit Spurs. He can make the tackles, but can also bring the ball out. And I think that's very important.
He looked like exactly
what they need.
In the due diligence I did ahead of talking about him here, he looked like where he's played before, he looked like he got forward quite a lot. But you don't expect him to do that for Spurs.
He can do, but I would expect him to take a more defensive role for Spurs. He's no Christian Eriksen replacement.
No,
and I think the fact that, you know, he can break up play is very, very important. That's something that I don't think he's a direct Eric Dier replacement, but they clearly need a player in that position who's got a little bit more mobility. And that's something that he's got. He's very athletic, really terrific for Benfica in European games, particularly last season. But it has been quiet for him this season. You know, he's only started two games in the Liga. And the way that Benfica have changed things a little bit under Bruno Lage has not really worked well for him. So clearly, both Spurs and Benfica can get benefit from this because I think people at Benfica are looking at how short he's come up this season and thinking, well, if Spurs eventually do end up paying 50 million for him, we've got ourselves a great deal here. Mm. And Spurs can look at it and think, this was a player who got a new contract at the start of the season with 130 million buyout clause,
right.
130 million euro buyout clause, which is the biggest buyout clause, not just in the history of Benfica, but in the history of Portuguese football. So they'll have both got themselves a deal if it works out.
Yeah, and also just short term, you get a player, presumably they're not paying him more than his existing contract at Benfica. So you're getting a player who's on, by Spurs' standards, quite a low salary that you're taking on loan for 18 months. And if he doesn't work out, you don't have to buy him. There's not an obligation to buy, right?
Yeah.
So it's a very sort of Daniel Levy sort of low risk, high potential reward type of deal. I think looking at his numbers, there's nothing that really stands out. So it'll be really interesting to see how he does under...
Do you think he'll thrive in that environment, given that he's probably going to need to hit the ground running straight away? Because Spurs need numbers badly, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And I think you've got to be a little bit patient with him because he's not played much this season. But, you know, he's someone who's a good player with loads of potential, very highly thought of. I think the fact that he already speaks excellent English.
His parents live in London, don't they?
Yeah, they have done for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Which I think, A, helps him settle, and B, shows you that he's had to be self-sufficient for the last couple of years. So I think those are things that play quite well for him as well.
And Norwich have brought in midfielders Andre Duda from Hertha Berlin and Lucas Rupp from Hoffenheim.
I like Duda a lot. I think this could be something pretty good for Norwich. I mean, he's thrived since coming over from the Czech Republic, where he really shone in European competition. He's done well both for Freiburg and Hertha. He's someone who can score goals from distance, and I would be reasonably confident about him settling in well. Lucas Rupp, it just feels like a body. I don't know. He's not someone who's even really a particularly great Bundesliga player. So it's a bit of a strange one.
Yeah. Our colleague, commentator and German football expert, Kevin Hatchard. Love Kevin. Lovely fella.
Good man.
Has already cast doubt on Rupp's ability to raise his game to Premier League level. He expressed that opinion in typical Kevin Hatchard diplomatic way. But I had to. I'm not going to put words in Kevin's mouth.
Can you put that in Google Translate and it come out as like how you would put it?
Well, I read it as Kevin saying that he's probably a load of old shit. So, what do you think, Lars? Andy said he's not a standout Bundesliga player anyway.
No, he works hard. He runs around, I guess, in the sort of Daniel Farke. Maybe
oh,
can
there's a compliment.
He runs around.
Yeah,
but Norwich, very, very likely are going down. I mean, and they're a team who have been very clear that they're not going to bet the farm in the transfer market.
Is the game Rupp for them?
Yeah.
Well, oh, God.
Wasn't worth it, Andy. Wasn't worth it. Stick to Batfink.
Yeah, so I will. I really will.
So, but the thing is, realistically, I mean, they want to be seen to be doing something, Norwich. They want to kind of give it their best shot. But regardless of how good Duda is, and you're saying he's the better of the two, it's not going to make a difference between them staying in the Premier League or not. So it does look like a bit of a kind of let's plan for next season type move for me. I'm not saying they should have gone for a high risk bet the farm type play, but this seems a bit kind of lip service-y
to me. I think it's interesting as well when you look at Duda, it's almost as if, I mean, he's been a good player for Hertha, not top five team want him sort of player, but a very, very serviceable player for Hertha, and he's had some really good spells there. It is very much them clearing the decks so they can get their posh new signings in.
Oh my God.
There we go. Let's do the one that Lars didn't want to do, because I agree. Lars, it's about compromise, this, because
That's fine.
You insisted on Inter, so I'm insisting on Ignacio Pesetto, who's coming to Watford on a 4.5-year deal with £7 million. Whenever I watch clips of him, he looks to be playing from the left, but he's listed as a right forward. Lars, you can clear that up for me and then also talk about what he's good at.
Well, he's a sort
shouldn't
of...
It shouldn't take you long.
It's not super exciting. It's fine. He's a sort of pretty hard-working wide player.
Can he play both flanks then?
Sure, but like predominantly on the right.
Okay.
But how he's turned up in your clips, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But the thing that stands out with him, I think, both from, I don't watch Udinese every week, but having watched him, he does seem to work quite hard. And looking at his numbers, he does win more tackles than what's normal for a winger. So I guess Nigel Pearson will like that. He likes a hard-working player. And in the situation that Watford find themselves in, that's completely fine.
And you're just chucking away, Andy, because you've got nothing to add, just enjoying Lars.
It's just not a super exciting transfer, is it?
That's pretty much it. I've not seen him nearly enough to make a judgment.
Okay, well,
I'm looking forward to this hard-tackling winger business.
Yeah, they've also signed João Pedro, an 18-year-old Brazilian player who even Nigel Pearson seemed to intimate isn't going to play. So, I mean, maybe that's one for the future. I'm sure it is.
Well, just going entirely again, I don't watch Udinese every week because, you know, but he won an average of 1.9 tackles per game last season, which is very high for a winger. So I think that's something that,
All right.
The dog wrestling Nigel Pearson will enjoy.
And finally, Aston Villa have looked to alleviate their goalkeeping problems. Tom Heaton and Jed Steer are both injured, of course, by signing Pepe Reina from Milan. Experienced, seen it, done it all that chutney. But can he make an impact? Does he still have the ability? Is he someone who's going to slot straight in there ahead
ahead of their third choice keeper?
Well, it's hard for us to tell because he's barely played since leaving Napoli.
Yeah. So, I can see what they got him. He knows the league, and he's like I say, he's done it
for
all.
Sure.
Yeah.
And he was very useful for Napoli until he ended up leaving there. It was always a bit of a strange one. They brought him in, obviously thinking that they were going to sell Donnarumma. It didn't happen. So he has been reduced to that sort of cheerleader role with the huge difference that there's not really much to cheer at Milan.
He's very good at it, though. I mean, if you were going to have someone doing it, you'd have him.
I was actually at his last game for Milan, and I was slightly taken aback by just how emotional the local crowd were about him leaving. I mean, when he was doing his big farewell walk around the stadium, there was a lot of love for Pepe Reina there.
Well, I'll tell you what, it'll all change when, you know, they've got Asmir Begovic in now, haven't they? I mean, you know, who couldn't be pleased about that? They'll be over the moon.
All right, let's turn our attention to games of the week then. I'll get mine out of the way very quickly. Real Madrid versus Sevilla is at 3 o'clock on Saturday.
Nice.
It always seems to be goals in that game. I know the last game, the game in Seville was 1-0, wasn't it? Or was it? Oh, God, I'm all over the place here. The game in Seville was 1-0 to Real Madrid.
Yeah.
But historically, there always seems to be goals. A couple of seasons ago, there was a 3-2 to Seville, and then Real Madrid beat them 5-0 at the Bernabeu.
There's been a 7-3 recently as well.
Has there really? I didn't know about that. Oh, yeah, there has. I've just checked. Look, back in 2013, 7-3. Can you name the goal scorers from that game?
No.
Gareth Bale got two. Cristiano Ronaldo got a hat-trick. And Karim Benzema helped himself to two as well. Rakitic and Carlos Bacca scoring for Sevilla. So, yeah, that'll be mine. Real Madrid v Sevilla, 3 p.m. Saturday. Lars?
My game of the weekend is RB Leipzig versus Union Berlin, the battle for the soul of the Bundesliga. The hipster favourites, Union Berlin versus the evil fizzy drink empire.
Yeah.
It's going to be spicy.
What, when is that, Lars?
It's on
to be fizzy.
It's on Saturday night. And I wonder, at what point does it become sort of almost countercultural to like RB Leipzig?
Yeah.
You come full circle.
Follow your heart. I find it a little bit tedious when everyone kind of you know, virtue signals about how real football is this and real football is that.
Well, you know the thing that disturbs me more than anything else about RB Leipzig? Have you seen their mascot?
Is he a big can?
Obviously, it's a Red Bull.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he's got, like, just the body of a muscly man. He's not got one of those big...
He's got a helmet on, yeah, I've seen it.
He's not got one of those big clumpy suits. He just looks like an athlete on steroids painted red, basically.
It's a perfect metaphor.
Is it?
No, it's an imperfect metaphor. I'm not saying I like the fact that, like, Red Bull are doing what they're doing, but I'm just saying, do you not find it a bit tedious when people kind of say they just arbitrarily decide that's a proper team, that isn't? And everyone just talks about it all the time.
For me, there are bigger problems in the world of football in terms of how certain clubs are run and in terms of where money is coming from elsewhere.
I think you have to look at it in the context of German football. And it's a very particular issue in Germany.
We're going to do some stuff on Germany next week, so maybe we'll do a bit of that as well. Andy, what's your game of the week, mate?
Well, you know what? I'm saying don't go out Friday night and treat yourself.
You sound like my wife.
Treat yourself because the big one that kicks off at 9:15 is Sporting versus Benfica.
Right.
Which is going to be fantastic. And as it still happens, it's going to be the latest last game of Bruno Fernandes before he leaves for Manchester United. You'll also get to see a bit of Julian Weigl as well, which will be quite nice. Of course, on his last visit to the Alvalade, he scored one of his rare goals for Dortmund as they won there in the Champions League. And that will be jolly exciting. Also, though, there's like the mini derby. If you go back, because as I said, Sporting Benfica, which is on Free Sports, by the way, so you can watch it for free.
And they've got HD now.
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
got an HD channel, so it's not like watching the past anymore.
Yeah, that's right. The thing is, as I said, it doesn't kick off till 9:15.
Is that Eusebio playing? That used to be that.
Yeah. So if you go back, I think it kicks off at 8, the mini derby.
Porto Braga.
Porto Braga is at 7. Yeah. I'm not sure if that's on British TV, although you'd be able to find it on some betting channel, obviously.
Yeah.
So you could back-to-back in Portugal. And there are multi-screens available to everyone these days.
Yeah.
You could watch the mini derby of Madrid, Leganes versus Getafe. And of course, for Sky customers, La Liga TV is free for the first fortnight, which is just launched in the UK. So you get to watch loads of Spanish football for nothing this weekend if you've got Sky.
They certainly did nobble you, didn't they, La Liga TV? Cut the canapes and you're already endorsing their product.
I mean, if you suggest to your other half that on a Friday night, watch a bit of Julian Weigl.
Yeah.
Do you not think she'll just think you're going to take her to a gig or something?
As soon as she found out he was a footballer, I wouldn't even get to the end of the sentence.
One of the most underrated smiles in European football, Julian Weigl.
Very specific.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.